Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the July 25th, 2025 issue of the Week. Our cover drawing this week, we have in the foreground Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem standing in what looks like a flood zone, trees and branches down, overturned cars, obviously has been flooded out. She's decked out in jeans, boots. She's got on a Homeland Security jacket and hat. She's putting a little bit of blush on her cheeks, and she's looking at, looks like she's got a phone set up for a selfie video hooked up to a generator. The headline is "A Disastrous Response. Is Noem to blame for FEMA aid delays in Texas?" That is our first main story. We'll start with that. FEMA's belated flood response in Texas. What happened? As recovery workers continued scouring a devastated Guadalupe River Valley in central Texas for bodies, the Trump administration denied reports that its steep cost-cutting measures hampered the Federal Emergency Management Agency's response to the flooding that killed at least 134 people, including 23 girls at Camp Mystic. Before the flood, Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem issued a rule that any FEMA expenditure over $100,000 required her personal sign-off. And the New York Times reported that this led to a serious delays and disruptions in the disaster response. Urban search and rescue teams were not deployed until more than 72 hours after flooding began. And because of contractor layoffs, FEMA reportedly failed to answer nearly two-thirds of the 21,000-plus calls to its disaster hotline. Noem, who last week repeated her call for the agency to be eliminated as it exists today, dismissed reports of FEMA's failures as fake news. Two Senate Democrats called for the investigation of FEMA and Noem by the Inspector General of the Department of Homeland Security. A disaster response system that must wait for one official's signature is unacceptable and designed to fail, said Senators Ruben Gallego, Democrat from Arizona, and Richard Blumenthal, Democrat from Connecticut. State and local officials also faced withering scrutiny of their failure to prepare for the disaster. As the Guadalupe River rose more than 26 feet in 45 minutes, a raging torrent of water hit Camp Mystic in the middle of the night, with camp officials waiting until it was too late to evacuate riverfront cabins filled with sleeping 8-year-old girls. Kerr County installed a warning system along the river following a deadly 1987 flood that killed 10 teenagers. But when the company managing the flood gauges shut down in 1998, the system was never replaced. The state denied local officials' appeal to fund a $1 million siren system in 2017. For political reasons, Kerr County also declined to spend part of a $10.2 million grant from President Biden's 2021 American Rescue Plan Act on a flood warning system, with one resident telling county commissioners, "We don't want to be bought by the federal government." What the editorial said: "You're doing a heck of a job, Secretary Noem," said the Houston Chronicle. "Disaster victims are supposed to receive $750 per family in emergency FEMA funds. But after Noem declined to renew some call center contracts, the agency's hotline went from answering 99.7% of calls that day to 35.8% the next day and 15.9% the day after." Meanwhile, Acting FEMA Director David Richardson failed to make any public appearances for 8 days. Ignoring disaster victims for days isn't governmental efficiency. It's heartless. "Leaders failed abjectly at every level, said the South Florida Sun Sentinel. When the Texas legislature debated a plan to establish a natural disaster response system, including critically important sirens, conservative State Representative Tony Tenderholt argued this shouldn't be about anything other than the fact that it's $500 million. Camp Mystic's owners, meanwhile, successfully appealed to FEMA to get 15 buildings removed from a 100-year flood zone. During a $5 million renovation in 2019, they chose not to relocate Riverside cabins to higher ground. What the columnist said. Climate change has brought us into a new flash flood era, said Mark Gongloff in Bloomberg, and not just in Texas. Dangerous floods have hit at least 10 states in recent weeks, from New York to New Mexico. Since warmer air can hold more water, we're starting to see 100 and even 1,000-year floods become almost routine. It's not a good time to be cutting disaster funds. Texas is also not unique in letting federal disaster money lie fallow, said Heather Richards in Politico. One federal disaster preparedness grant program has helped more than $23 billion on states. Excuse me, has heaped more than $23 billion on states since 2015, but only $2 billion has been spent. Even when that aid isn't politicized, states and counties often lack the staff, expertise, or bandwidth to navigate a cumbersome federal process to tap those funds. The painful truth, said Costas Sinalakis in the Wall Street Journal, is that weather extremes are outpacing our preparedness. Vulnerable communities need layered alert systems of sirens, phone alerts, and flash flood drills. But decades of false complacency left Kerr County acutely vulnerable. The little girls at Camp Mystic drowned in a flood of failures, failures of imagination, investment, and political will. And a second shorter main story, arms for Ukraine and an ultimatum for Russia. What happened? In a surprise turnaround on the Ukraine war, President Trump said this week that the U.S. would continue supplying weapons to Ukraine and would inflict economic pain on Russia if it failed to make a peace deal. After an Oval Office meeting with NATO Chief Mark Rutte, Trump said NATO allies had agreed to buy a full complement of U.S. weapons, including Patriot missile batteries, to give Ukraine, portraying the deal as lucrative for the U.S. And he said that if Russia did not agree to a ceasefire within 50 days, he would apply tariffs of 100% on countries like China and India, that import Russian oil and other goods. Trump has increasingly expressed frustration with the duplicity of Russian President Vladimir Putin. My conversations with him are always very pleasant, he said, and then missiles go off that night. On a recent call with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, Trump reportedly floated the idea of Ukraine striking Moscow and St. Petersburg, although this week he walked that back and said Zelensky should not do so. Republican lawmakers who had previously opposed aid to Ukraine fell in line after the president's announcement. I call him the peacemaker-in-chief, said Representative Derek Van Orden, Republican from Wisconsin. He has my 100% absolute unequivocal support. Meanwhile, despite the ultimatum, Russia continued pounding Ukraine this week, launching hundreds of drone and missile strikes on six Ukrainian regions and targeting civilian buildings. Zelensky's hometown, Kryvyi Rih, suffered its biggest attack since the war began. What the columnist said. What a change from a few months ago, said Andreas Kluth in Bloomberg. In February, Trump bullied Zelensky in the Oval Office and blamed the victim, Kyiv, for starting the war. Now Trump seems to have had a change of heart, and if so, he should do more than just send weapons. For starters, he could revive the bipartisan bill now languishing in Congress that would let the U.S. seize Russia's overseas central bank assets and give them to Ukraine. That would hit Putin where it hurts. It's good that Trump has finally realized that Putin has been playing him, said Jonathan Sweet and Mark Toth in The Hill. But why did he give Russia so long to come to the table? He's effectively giving Putin a 50-day license to continue targeting Ukrainian civilians, men, women, and children alike. Ukraine will now face 7 more weeks of relentless and unabated aerial bombardments on its cities, and Russia will use that time to steal more Ukrainian territory, particularly the areas that contain rare earth minerals. Still, Trump is now putting effective pressure on Putin, said the Washington Post in an editorial. He hopes to force substantive negotiations by brandishing an economic weapon, secondary sanctions, the United States has hesitated to use. It's a powerful tool. Unfortunately, given Trump's penchant for threatening and then backing down, the Russians may doubt that the U.S. will follow through and actually impose the sanctions. This time, Trump must prove to Putin that he means what he says. Controversy of the week. Epstein. Why MAGA won't move on. Having nurtured conspiracy theories for his entire career, Donald Trump is suddenly in danger of being consumed by one, said Michelle Goldberg in the New York Times. His MAGA movement is in revolt this week over the insistence by Trump, his Justice Department, and the FBI that there are no incriminating client lists or scandalous new documents to be revealed regarding Jeffrey Epstein, the disgraced financier found dead in his jail cell in 2019 while awaiting trial on trafficking underage girls. The statement sparked immediate fury and disappointment on the right, where MAGA influencers, including now FBI Director Kash Patel and his deputy Don Bongino, have insisted for years that Epstein was murdered by the deep state and that the release of a client list would expose a sprawling cabal of elite liberal pedophiles. Most of the MAGA rage was initially directed at Attorney General Pam Bondi, who said in February she had the Epstein list sitting on my desk and then announced last week that no list existed. Trump then began taking fire when he implored weakling supporters not to waste time and energy on Jeffrey Epstein, somebody that nobody cares about. But MAGA influencers like Tucker Carlson, Alex Jones, and Steve Bannon are continuing to stoke MAGA's rage, warning Trump, in Jones' words, that this isn't going away. Trump's quandary is that he's in the Epstein files, said William Crystal in The Bulwark. He was friends with Epstein, a neighbor in Palm Beach, Florida, for 15 years. Trump once said they had a shared taste in beautiful women, adding with a chuckle that Epstein liked his on the younger side. Trump flew more than once to Epstein's notorious jet, the Lolita Express, and author Michael Wolff recently claimed that Epstein showed him photos taken at his home of topless young women sitting on Trump's lap. No wonder his DOJ says that no further disclosure of Epstein documents, photos, and videos would be warranted. To add to the suspicion, said Steve Bannon in MSNBC.com, Trump is now saying that the Epstein files were written by Obama, Crooked Hillary, Comey, and his other political enemies. So is Trump's position now that the files do exist, but they're fake? Files from the lengthy federal investigation no doubt exist, said Andrew McCarthy in National Review, but the Justice Department and the FBI are not in the transparency business, and it would be highly unethical for them to release documents naming people who associated with Epstein but were not charged with crimes. Good luck convincing MAGA of that, said John Marshall in Talking Points memo. It's cult-like belief that a cabal of rich and powerful pedophiles controls the world, runs really, really deep. And if Trump keeps stonewalling, the Epstein wildfire will continue to burn out of control. This has to be bewildering for Trump, said Amanda Marcotte in Salon. If his fans can shrug off his own history of sexual assault, why are they so hung up on Epstein? The answer lies in the age of the victims. It's only by positioning themselves as righteous warriors against pedophilia, the through line of MAGA conspiracy theories from Pizzagate to QAnon, that Trump supporters find moral absolution. Trump fans need the Epstein files if they're to keep seeing themselves as the good guys. If they think Trump is protecting pedophiles, they may see him as another villain, and themselves for what they are, his accomplices. It was a good week, bad week piece. It was a good week for mother tongues. After President Trump asked Liberian President Joseph Boakai during a White House meeting how the African leader learned to speak English so beautifully, Boakai simply smiled rather than informing Trump that English is Liberia's official language. It was a good week for long, strange trips. After a study found that psilocybin, the active ingredient in psychedelic mushrooms, increases the cellular lifespan of human cells and boosted the actual lifespan of laboratory mice by up to 30%. And it was a good week for vibing. After Britain's Heathrow Airport announced plans to pipe airport sounds into its departure terminals, musician Jordan Rickey said he hoped his aural collage of escalators, hurrying footsteps, and planes taking off will give travelers an even deeper experience of that whole pre-flight vibe. But it was a bad week for Luddites after indie rock legend Jack White announced that thanks to a 50th birthday gift from his wife, I am now the reluctant owner of a cellular telephone for the first time in my life. White added that he is proud of myself for holding out this long. It's a bad week for full disclosure. After an internal review by Britain's BBC concluded that it was a significant oversight not to inform viewers that the narrator of a documentary about Israel's war in Gaza was the son of a Hamas official. "We've said we're sorry," said BBC News Chief Deborah Turnus. Finally, it was a bad week for never growing up. After Elon Musk released a penis-shaped map of Tesla's robo-taxi service area in Austin with a caption, "Harder, better, faster, stronger." An analysis by tech blog Electric concluded that the geographic shape of the service area appears to be solely to satisfy Musk's famously juvenile sense of humor. And in other news, Senate moves to claw back funds for foreign aid and PBS. In a win for the Trump administration, the Senate voted this week to take up legislation that would revoke nearly $9 billion in government funding. The initiative passed 51-50 with Vice President J.D. Vance casting the tie-breaking vote, and Republicans hope to pass the bill within days. The legislation would claw back about $8 billion meant for foreign assistance programs and about $1.1 billion earmarked for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which funds NPR and PBS. It would, however, maintain $400 million in funding for international AIDS relief. The Trump administration has faced a series of lawsuits contending that the White House's cuts fell afoul of congressional control over federal spending. Court blocked the foreign aid cuts in March. A congressional decision to take back the money would give President Trump a much clearer legal path to eliminate the programs. Briefing. The all-seeing tech giant. Palantir's data mining tools are used by spies and the military. Are they now being turned on Americans? What does Palantir do? named after the mystical seeing stones in J.R.R. Tolkien's Lord of the Rings, the secretive tech firm sells software that can crunch colossal troves of data. Depending on the application, that might include GPS data, text messages, social media profiles, legal filings, phone records, and thousands of other information points, which it distills into charts, maps, and other forms of intelligence. Palantir's specialty is detecting connections and patterns, the finding of hidden things, as CEO Alex Karp puts it. The company was launched in 2003 by Peter Thiel, tech billionaire and major Trump donor, and Karp, a self-described neo-Marxist with a philosophy PhD, and seeded with $2 million from the CIA. The intelligence agency used Palantir software to track terrorists after 9/11. It is widely believed to have helped the U.S. locate and kill Osama bin Laden, and the firm has helped Ukraine's military identify Russian targets. Los Angeles police track crime patterns, and J.P. Morgan Chase combat cyber fraud. But most of Palantir's work is for the U.S. government, and business is booming. Since President Trump's January inauguration, it has won more than $900 million in federal contracts, and its share price has more than doubled. Palantir is on fire, Karp told a May earnings call. Which agencies work with the company? Palantir's tools are used across many agencies for a wide range of purposes. It has helped the CDC track disease outbreaks, the IRS sniff out tax cheats, the FDA monitor supply chains, and the Department of Homeland Security chase down drug traffickers. Most controversially, during the first Trump administration, it helped Homeland Security track undocumented migrants, prompting pushback from employees and protest at Palantir's Palo Alto and Manhattan offices. In April, CNN and Wired reported that Palantir engineers were helping build a master database that will draw data from across federal agencies, including the IRS, Social Security Administration, and Health and Human Services, to target undocumented immigrants. The firm is helping build the infrastructure of the police state, charged tech investor Paul Graham. Palantir's biggest government client, though, is the Defense Department, with whom it has a $1.3 billion contract running through 2029. How does the military use its tech? In Palantir's early years, the Marine Corps deployed its software in Afghanistan to better predict the locations of roadside bombs and potential insurgent ambushes. The company is now helping the Pentagon develop the Maven Smart System, which uses AI to analyze satellite imagery, drone footage, radar feeds, ground reports, and other data to present commanders with battlefield options. The Pentagon has already used the technology to identify airstrike targets in Yemen, Syria, and Iraq. Palantir has also worked closely with the Ukrainian military, embedding engineers with troops, and recently signed a $91 million deal with Britain's defense ministry. They are the AI arms dealer of the 21st century, said Jacob Hallberg, a national security expert and outside advisor to Karp. Palantir's defense work, especially the use of its software by Israel in Gaza, has drawn condemnation from inside and outside the company. How has Palantir responded? Karp, who's called himself a progressive warrior, acknowledges that using AI-driven algorithms to aid killings is morally complex, but he believes that in a world full of malevolent forces bent on America's destruction, survival depends on leveraging our technological advantages, and that tech firms must aid that effort. A lot of this does come down to, do you think America is a beacon of good or not, he said. Palantir aims to help power the West to the obvious innate superiority and bring violence and death to our enemies. When it comes to other key charge leveled at Palantir, that its software is being put to nefarious ends by the government, Karp insists his company can't dictate how its tools are used. But alarm spiked in May when the New York Times reported that the Trump administration had tapped the firm to compile Americans' personal data. What kind of information? The federal government has copious data on U.S. citizens, ranging from incomes and student debts to criminal histories, charitable contributions, and medical claims. Such data is currently siloed across agencies, but the Times reported that Trump, who in March signed an executive order directing agencies to remove unnecessary barriers to data consolidation, had drafted Palantir to build a centralized database that pulls all that disparate information together. Why is there alarm over a centralized database? Privacy advocates say that this library of information could be weaponized by the government. Officials could access and release embarrassing details about critics' finances and health conditions, for example, or terminate benefits they receive. The creation of a monster uniform database, said Representative Jamie Raskin, the Democrat from Maryland, is an invitation to fraud and political retaliation against the people. It's not just Democrats who are raising warnings. Such data consolidation is a power that history says will eventually be abused, said Representative Warren Davidson, Republican from Ohio. Palantir denies it is building a master database or enabling mass surveillance of citizens, but even one-time insiders are troubled by the company's growing power. In May, 13 ex-Palantir engineers signed a letter saying the firm's leadership has abandoned its founding ideals and become complicit in normalizing authoritarianism. They cited the crystal ball-like seeing stones that gave Palantir its name. These magical artifacts were not necessarily a force for good, they noted, but presented great dangers when wielded by those without wisdom or a moral compass. And a few of the best columns. First two come from the U.S. A president protected by God. Whispers of messianism could be heard from some of President Trump's staunchest supporters for years, said Isaac Arnsdorf. But when a would-be assassin shot and wounded Trump during a campaign rally in Butler, Pennsylvania, a year ago this week, his survival marked a turning point for the religious dimension to Trump's movement. The shooter's near miss strengthened evangelicals' belief that Trump is a divine instrument chosen by God to save the nation from the heathen left. During the Republican National Convention, shortly after the shooting, talk of divine intervention shifted from private rumblings to primetime stage, where influential conservative podcaster Tucker Carlson said Trump had been transformed into something larger than a mere man. Never known for his personal piety, Trump reportedly said that his near miss proved that God exists. I was saved by God, he said at his second inaugural, to make America great again. Lisa Carnes, an attendee at the Butler rally, is among the many Trump fans who believe him. It took a very strong man who could help write our country back to being God's country, she said. I do feel like God protected him. SCOTUS's partisan hypocrisy. The Supreme Court has issued another radical ruling that gives President Trump an unprecedented amount of power, said Mark Joseph Stern. The six justices in the conservative majority allowed the Trump administration to move forward with its firing of 1,400 Department of Education employees as part of his plan to abolish the department. The ruling was made through the shadow docket, without any legal justification, and accelerates this administration's lawless seizure of duties and prerogatives that the Constitution expressly assigned to Congress. In earlier rulings, the court allowed Trump to fire the heads of previously independent agencies and said no lower federal court may issue nationwide injunctions on Trump's actions. When Joe Biden was president, the court's conservatives repeatedly limited his authority, barring him from forgiving federal student loans, enforcing environmental laws, and deciding major questions without the permission of Congress and the courts. Trump, however, can bypass Congress to eliminate the Education Department because, well, he's a Republican. Could anyone really defend this partisan hypocrisy with a straight face? What we're seeing is what happened in Hungary and Turkey. Strongman leader works with a captured judiciary to hobble the legislature, consolidate power, and declare himself free from legal restraints on his reign. This column comes from the Netherlands. Making it a crime to help illegals. Dutch lawmakers are trying to ban human kindness, said Carolus Gruters. Right-wing populists have just pushed through the lower house of parliament a pair of bills cracking down on asylum seekers, including an amendment added at the last minute that would criminalize illegal residents. That means citizens and local officials who help undocumented people in any way would be guilty of complicity in a crime. If these bills pass the upper house, Dutch do-gooders could be punished for offering asylum seekers anything from a kind word to a donation to a bed for the night. Towns that provide homeless shelters would be in violation of the law every time someone undocumented stayed the night. Michelle van Tongerloo, the self-described Rotterdam street doctor who provides first aid to the most disadvantaged in our society, could not only be fined, but might even be forced to spend a night in jail. Such an outcome would be outrageous. Dr. van Tongerloo deserves a statue. Every Dutch advisory body that looked at this legislation, from outside expert advice to parliamentary staffers, notes to the Council of State itself, said, don't do this. And every holy book, no matter the religion, calls on us to help the least fortunate. Let's hope the upper house listens to that universal calling and kills the amendment. Aiding the downtrodden should not be a crime. The last word, our in-depth article. American bloodlust. The U.S. has been racked by episodes of political violence since its founding, said Adrian LaFrance in The Atlantic. History suggests the current outbreak will get worse unless we take a stand. You would be forgiven for not knowing which lesson exactly Americans ought to take from the bloody morning of September 13, 1859. On that day, in the mouth of a clearing by Lake Merced in the hills of San Francisco, two men decided to settle an argument the old-fashioned way, with a pair of handcrafted 58 caliber pistols and a mutual death wish. David Broderick and David Terry had originally traveled westward in search of gold, Broderick from his hometown of Washington, D.C., and Terry by way of Russellville, Kentucky. Instead, they found careers in public service, which is how they crossed paths. Broderick is a U.S. Senator. Terry is a Chief Justice of the California Supreme Court. They were both Democrats, but very different kinds of Democrats, at a moment when those differences were matters of life and death. Over the years, their friendship had been badly strained by the question of slavery. Terry was for it, Broderick against. This disagreement hardened into disgust. Their relationship fell apart publicly and spectacularly. The duel ended as duels often did, quickly and irreversibly. 10 paces, wheel around, fire. Broderick had a reputation as a superior marksman. He was also given first dibs on his position at the dueling grounds. But neither advantage did him any good. The hair trigger on his pistol, the guns, with their smooth walnut handles, had been provided by a Terry ally, meant that Broderick accidentally fired too early, the bullet disappearing into the sandy soil at his feet. Terry knew he could take his time. He aimed the pistol carefully. He shot. Broderick crumpled. He died 3 days later. Duels were still common in those days, although they were not exactly popular with the public. They were tolerated. At the time, the U.S. Navy lost two-thirds as many men to duels as to combat. Duels were a matter of honor and an established political right. Broderick's murder changed all of that. He was the first, and still the only, sitting U.S. senator to be killed in a duel. His death made headlines nationwide as newspapers recounted the face-off obsessively. The public was mesmerized by the coverage, but also repulsed by the violence. After that, Americans still dueled here and there, but not as they had before. Today, many consider the Broderick-Terry duel to have been the last real American duel, the one that turned the nation against dueling once and for all. I was thinking about Broderick and Terry recently after a gunman disguised as a police officer assassinated the lawmaker Melissa Hortman, along with her husband Mark, in their Minnesota home last month. For many years, I have been preoccupied by questions about political violence in America, most of all with the question of how to interrupt a cycle of political violence before more people are killed. In addition to the recent assassinations in Minnesota, Americans have in the past year alone witnessed two assassination attempts against Donald Trump, the Midtown Manhattan murder of the United Healthcare CEO, an arson attack at the home of Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro, the murder of a young couple leaving the Capitol Jewish Museum in Washington, D.C., the murder of an 82-year-old woman in a firebombing attack in Colorado, and the attempted kidnapping of the mayor of Memphis. With startling frequency, Americans are attempting to resolve political disagreement through violence. And all the while, leaders at the highest levels of American government are aggressively stoking this national bloodlust and demonstrating a willingness to carry out violence against citizens. The President of the United States has repeatedly fantasized about violently hurting and even killing Americans. He describes those who disagree with him politically as vermin and has said that the threat from outside forces is far less sinister, dangerous, and grave than the threat from within. Trump infamously mused about executing General Mark Milley, then the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and proceeded to take away Milley's security detail. Trump has repeatedly described in bizarre detail his desire to see American journalists suffer. He is specifically preoccupied with fantasies of journalists being beaten and raped in prison. According to Trump's former Defense Secretary Mark Esper, Trump implored Esper to have troops shoot into a crowd of protesters. Trump has denied this. Trump promised he would act as a dictator on the first day of his second term, and on that day he pardoned more than 1,500 people who had been convicted for their actions in the 2021 insurrection, including those with ties to various extremist groups and those who had violently attacked law enforcement at the U.S. Capitol. We're not yet at the level of violence that plagued the nation during the Civil War, nor even at the level of violence that ripped through American cities in the years before and after World War I, when dynamite attacks were common. Scholars lately have been debating whether things are officially as bad as they were in the 1960s and 70s. Still, no matter where you fall on the spectrum of these debates, political violence in America is clearly worsening across several key measures. Vigilante justice is on the rise, mostly in the form of lone wolf attacks, or what the FBI sometimes calls salad bar extremism. At the same time, organized violence may be poised to resurge, not only because so many leaders of violent extremist groups recently waltzed out of prison with their golden ticket Trump pardons, but also because of the ever more extreme tenor of political debate in America. In a recent report from a nonpartisan group at Princeton University about the biggest threats we face in 2025, researchers found that immigrant groups are at an especially high risk of political violence this year and for the foreseeable future. Proposed bounty bills, in particular, could embolden private citizens to engage in self-styled enforcement actions targeting immigrants and their allies, the report said. A 2024 poll shows that as many as one in five Americans believes they have to resort to violence to get what they want. A more recent poll shows that even more Americans, one in three, believe that because things have gotten so far off track, Americans may have to resort to violence in order to save our country. Political violence is, of course, fundamentally at odds with the philosophy of democratic self-governance. This is because violence poses an existential threat to the conditions, Republican independence and freedom from government interference, chief among them, that allow for people to hold power. Or as Sarah Birch, the author of Electoral Violence, Corruption, and Political Order, has put it, a community that will tolerate violence will get violence. A community that does not tolerate violence is much less likely to have violence. Birch has argued that it is up to every single citizen to condemn violence and to talk in such a way that makes it unacceptable. She's right that the communities that tolerate violence will get it. They'll get it from vigilantes, from organized extremist groups, and most concerning of all, from the state itself. Throughout history and around the world, periods of political violence have been met with the enthusiastic opportunism of those who seek to quash democracy and seize power for themselves. I don't have to tell you that Trump seems particularly eager for such opportunities to come his way. His record speaks for itself. Back in Broderick and Terry's day, public revulsion over the duel ended Terry's political career. But not just that. His eagerness and that of other defenders of slavery to resort to violence doomed their cause. And so, among the several lessons that one might take from the bloody events of September 13, 1859, there is this. Nothing good can happen between two furious men pointing pistols at each other before dawn. Also, if you believe in settling arguments with violence against those who you disagree with you, you should expect to die that way. And if you look away while others resolve their differences violently, if you believe you can comfortably compartmentalize certain kinds of violence from a safe distance, you should expect to die for what you believe too, because political violence does not stay contained or ideologically pure. Political violence has a way of perpetuating itself, feeding on itself, spilling ever more blood until enough people are willing to say no more. There is another infamous tremor of political violence that I've been thinking about lately. This particular incident happened 3 years before Broderick's death on May 22, 1856. That day, Preston Brooks, a congressman from South Carolina, confronted Charles Sumner, a congressman from Massachusetts, over, once again, their differing views on slavery. Brooks owned slaves and wanted to keep it that way. Sumner was an abolitionist. So right there on the Senate floor, Brooks lifted his thick metal-topped cane and beat Sumner until blood ran into his eyes and he slipped into unconsciousness. Brooks didn't stop beating him until the cane had broken apart into bloody pieces. Today, people remember Brooks' attack for its terrible brutality and sheer pettiness. But in retrospect, one of its most terrifying aspects is not the violence itself, as horrible as it was, but what came next. Sumner was permanently injured and would spend years trying to regain basic functions. Brooks never apologized for what he did. He only doubled down. Yet after the attack, Brooks' many supporters in Congress took to wearing fragments of the broken cane, fashioned into rings that they strung around their necks, in a gruesome showing of solidarity And then the people of South Carolina reelected him. They began to send him new canes, more than he could ever use, bearing inscriptions such as, "Hit him again and good job." This wasn't just tolerance of political violence or forgiveness of it, but full-throated support. Often it is only when events recede into history that a society can see clearly what it has endured and how close it has come to disaster. For generations, a portrait of Charles Sumner that hangs in the Capitol went mostly unnoticed. But on January 6, 2021, there it was in the background of photos showing the unthinkable. Insurrectionists stalking the halls of the Capitol, 150 years after the end of the Civil War, waving the Confederate flag under Sumner's nose. The mass pardoning of those who attacked the U.S. Capitol is a clear message. Good job. Hit him again. It need not be this way. It should not be this way. But right now, it is. And it will get worse until Americans demand otherwise. From one another, from our elected officials, from ourselves. A society in which people resign to resolve their differences through bloodshed will eventually carry that logic to every possible argument, every small town, and every last household. This is our national paradox. Political violence is deeply, inescapably American. It has been this way since the very beginning. The first recorded duel in the New World took place in 1621, not long after the landing at Plymouth. Our nation was born in a swirl of revolution and musket smoke, and episodes of political violence can be found in every decade since we declared our independence. Yet for us to build the country we have promised ourselves and that we have promised our children, for the guarantee of the very freedoms our fellow citizens have fought and died for, we must find a way for America to be America without killing one another over what we want this nation to be. We must insist on resolving political differences passionately but peacefully. We must return to power only those who believe in decency, honor, and dignity, not only for their political allies, but for all Americans. Two centuries ago, Americans defended their honor through acts of violence against one another. Today, Americans should defend their honor through the courage to show restraint. It is too late for David Broderick, and for Bobby Kennedy, and for Martin Luther King Jr., and for Melissa Hortman, and for every other American who was ever lynched, executed, tortured, or killed for their beliefs. But it is not too late for this nation and its citizens to choose peace. A version of this story was originally published in The Atlantic. One of the obituaries. The D.C. operative who served four presidents, David Gergen, 1942 to 2025. David Gergen was the consummate Beltway insider. Over decades in D.C., he served as an aide to four presidents, Republicans Richard Nixon, Gerald Ford, and Ronald Reagan, and Democrat Bill Clinton. Wearing hats, including speechwriter, special counsel, and communications director, the centrist Gergen was known as a spinmeister who could craft a presidential message and work with reporters to get it out. Towering at 6'5", he was no arm twister, but rather a genial smoozer who targeted leaks earned him the nickname The Sieve. He worked most closely with Reagan, writing one of the great communicator's most effective lines. During a 1980 debate against Jimmy Carter, the Republican candidate asked voters, "Are you better off than you were 4 years ago?" The question resonated in an era of economic malaise, and when it helped Reagan to a landslide win, "When you're out there panhandling in the river," said Gergen, Occasionally, you get a gold nugget. David Richmond Gergen was born in Durham, North Carolina, where his father taught math at Duke University, said the Washington Post. He attended Yale University and Harvard Law, then served as a Navy officer during the Vietnam War, stationed on a ship in Japan. With many career paths open to him, his entry into politics was fortuitous. On a friend's tip, he applied for a job assisting Nixon's speechwriter, even though, as he admitted during the interview, he'd voted for Democrat Hubert Humphrey. He was brought aboard anyway and soon rose to head speechwriter, helping craft Nixon's resignation letter in 1974. In the Reagan White House, the pragmatic Gergen was widely credited with softening the in-your-face conservative rhetoric sought by far-right aides, said the New York Times. That centrism appealed to Clinton, who brought him on board in 1993. But between Clinton aides who mistrusted Gergen as an interloper and Republicans who deemed him a turncoat, he lasted barely a year in the Clinton White House. Between stints in the government, said the Guardian, he had success in media and academia. Sometime editor of U.S. News and World Report, and a frequent columnist and TV news commentator. He also taught government at both Duke and Harvard's Kennedy School. Always, he preached the values of civility and compromise. Centrism doesn't mean splitting the difference, he said in 2020. It's about seeking solutions, and you bring people along. And over on the Talking Points page, Musk's third party. Could it work? Elon Musk is inserting himself into American politics again, said Jim Garrity in the Washington Post. This time it's with his newly formed political party, the rather generically named America Party. President Trump's former first buddy announced his new venture on July 4th, describing it as a viable third party option to challenge both Democrats and Republicans. His initial strategy is to recruit candidates to run in a handful of competitive House and state and Senate races, which could deny the two major parties an outright majority in Congress and force them to bargain with Musk-backed legislators for votes. Obviously, Musk launched this party in an effort to gain revenge against Trump and the GOP for ignoring his warnings about the trillions in deficit spending in the now-passed budget bill. His party would promote a fiscally conservative and socially liberal, if not libertine, agenda. But libertarian candidates rarely draw more than single-digit vote percentages, and Musk's party may be a supply looking for a demand. The America Party will probably go nowhere, said Jonah Goldberg in the Los Angeles Times. Since he is an immigrant, Musk can't run for president himself, which means he needs to find quality candidates to carry the party's banner. This might prove difficult, given that his right-wing views have made him toxic among Democrats, while his ongoing feud with Trump has alienated the MAGA base. Still, Musk does have a chance to make a difference in 2026, said Jeremy Meyer in USA Today. The margins in Congress are so tight that he would need as few as 3 seats in both the House and Senate to become a power broker. Given the record dissatisfaction with our political system, a third party that pushes Democrats and Republicans to get things done sounds a lot like what Americans say they want. Musk clearly underestimates the complexity of launching a third party, said Andy Craig in MSNBC.com. Even with effectively infinite money to burn, the practical, legal, and political barriers are immense. No third-party candidate has been elected to Congress since Senator James Buckley in 1970. The No Labels Party, founded as a supposed centrist alternative, couldn't find anyone to run for president in 2024 and folded. How many Americans would vote for Elon Musk stand-ins? The America Party will very likely join the long list of ambitious centrist parties that flamed out without gaining any traction or power. And a few of the short notes. North Atlantic seas contain at least 27 million metric tons of nanoplastics, microscopic plastic fragments invisible to the naked eye, according to a new study published in the journal Nature. That's more than the weight of all wild land animals. Nearly two-thirds of the Justice Department lawyers charged with defending Trump administration policies against legal challenges have quit or announced plans to leave since the 2024 election. Speaking off the record, seven lawyers attributed their departure to a ballooning workload and the prospect of defending decisions they deem legally unjustifiable. The U.S. is poised to have more executions in 2025 than at any point in the past 10 years, with Florida's scheduled lethal injection of 54-year-old Michael Bernard Bell this week, bringing the count to 26, more than were executed all last year. Another nine executions are scheduled for later in the year, representing a potential 40% increase since 2024. On the poll watch, 81% of Americans say whoever is president makes some difference in their personal lives, with 30% saying it has a big impact. And we'll finish with a quote from the Dutch writer Corrie ten Boom, who says, "Worrying does not empty tomorrow of its sorrow. It empties today of its strength." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.